Hi, everybody. Hope you all had a lovely afternoon tea, and you've now, after having experienced the NDIS and My Aged Care sessions, are poised to make the best possible use of your plans. And if not, then see Lauren and Crystal. I'm sure they can help. But seriously, we are here this afternoon for the next hour or so to talk about a subject which has already actually come up a number of times in our workshops yesterday afternoon, and that is emotional well-being and mental health and the intersection between blindness and emotional well-being. And it's not a topic which we often talk about, but it's probably a topic which we need to talk about more, which is why the Convention Program Planning Committee was very keen that we put this into the program. And I guess before I introduce the panel members that I have with me up here today, I just wanted to talk about what do we actually mean by emotional well-being, and why does it matter in terms of blindness? And I guess some of the things that we've been talking about as a panel have been the fact that you'll recall that, of course, Fred has been talking a lot about low expectations and how what a significant impact the low expectations of society can have on people who are blind or vision impaired. That is certainly an issue which plays into people's sense of self and sense of well-being. Equally important, though, I think, is the high expectations that we, as people who are blind or vision impaired, place upon ourselves, and that society sometimes, or particularly our families, sometimes place on us, particularly if we've been blind since birth, and that can equally have an impact. Of course, we know that emotional well-being doesn't necessarily have anything to do with blindness. So I certainly don't want us to come away with the view that anyone who experiences any kind of mental health issue must be due to blindness. Sometimes it has nothing to do with it whatsoever. But today we're going to be looking at the particular intersection between emotional well-being and blindness. So I just want to start by introducing our panellists. We have Paula Hobley with us. Paula has a social work background, and she's a social... and she's a student doing a PhD in relation to the emotional well-being of people with early onset blindness and vision impairment. So that's Paula's background. Then we have Bonnie Sturrock, who's from the Centre for Eye Research Australia, and Bonnie is a research fellow and a clinical psychologist who's been doing work in a similar area around emotional well-being, researching the intersection between emotional well-being and blindness. And then we have Vanessa Ransley, and Vanessa is a BCA member. Some of you will have heard her sing last night. She sings quite a lot. But she also works in music education. She's a music teacher and experiences anxiety. And I think I should also say at this point that I myself also experience anxiety, and I think it's important to say that, not because, you know, I want people's sympathy, because I don't, but just to say that people often think that leaders, people in leadership positions, are exempt from mental health issues, or that they're actually not allowed to experience mental health issues and they have to be on top of all those things. The reality is that's, I think, almost never the case, and I think that people who lead often experience mental health issues. It's very difficult for people to talk about them, but I think that in our community it's important that our leaders stand up and if they're comfortable to do so and actually talk about these issues, because I think it helps everybody else feel more comfortable to talk about these issues if people in leadership roles are leading by example. So that's why I'm... was very keen to chair this session. So I'm going to start with Paula, if that's okay. And Paula's going to spend a bit of time talking to us about her research and doing a bit of a practical exercise. Then I'm going to talk with Vanessa about some of her experiences, and then I'll hand over to Bonnie to talk about her research. So Paula, can I hand over to you now, please? Oh, actually, sorry, one more very important thing before I do, is that it is possible that this session might trigger some things for some people. And if it does, or even if you just feel like you need to leave the room, please feel free to do so. And remember that if you need to put your hand up and get the assistance of a volunteer or send a text message about that, we can accommodate that. Also, if you do feel like you need to talk to someone afterwards, the number for Lifeline, of course, is in the program, but it's 13 11 14. And the other option is also to have a conversation with your GP or someone else that you trust. So we certainly don't want anyone to feel like they don't have options. And we're all here as well afterwards if you need to talk. So, Paula, I'll hand over to you now. Thanks.
So leading on from what Emma was talking about, I thought before I subject you to my practical exercise, I thought I would just tell you a little bit about why I'm what led me to research this area. Growing up in a rural area, going through school, moving to uni, you know, doing the whole undergraduate degrees, finding and maintaining jobs, and all of the issues that sort of come up, you know, throughout that process. In particular, it's not just about getting the job; it's keeping the job. Made me start to think, well, what is it like for people who are blind or vision impaired as a group? Is there, you know, what are the factors that influence emotional well-being here? So that led me to do some research, as Emma said, with people with early onset blindness or vision impairment. I measured the emotional well-being against the age range, which is 18 to 34 of the same, for the general population. So I measured my participants' subjective well-being scores, found similarities with regard to standard of living, life achievements, and personal relationships, but there were differences when it came to satisfaction with health, feeling of safety, community involvement, and future security. So, just sort of reflecting on that and thinking about, well, what are the things, and as Emma said, they don't have to be about blindness specifically, but I wonder sometimes too whether it may not be a blindness-specific issue, but as someone pointed out to me once, maybe the way that we deal with the issue might be different because of our vision impairment. So I'd like to hand it over to our audience and encourage some group discussion about what are some factors and if we can keep them general and not get so much into people's personal stories, because I think, that, again, that's where things can be triggered. What are some things that contribute to, you know, our emotional well-being, and what are some things that take away from it? And I can start, if that would make people feel a bit more comfortable, and say for me one of the things is travel and planning travel and, you know, making sure that I'm, you know, how do I get around Southern Cross Station, how do I get around Flinders Street because I don't live in Melbourne, all of those things I find really stressful and they sort of take away. But in terms of contributing, I would say my relationship with all of my guide dogs has definitely boosted my feeling of subjective well-being. So who'd like to be brave? Do we have a roaming
yes,
mic?
Yes, we do. Yep.
Yep.
I'd say resilience, to figure out if and what you need.
Hang on a sec. That's okay.
My name's Pauline Cornell and I'm in my 70s, so it's finding resilience post being divorced and starting to move into another state, acquiring a guide dog and getting on with life. Finding a number of things. So going back to the word resilience, and I found that word listening to Anne Summers' book that was all about resilience, and looking at literature, trying to find programs or workshops that would help and guide me to be a strong parent, a single parent of three adult children and all their problems, and to get on and make a life interstate, having returned from overseas minus the husband. So you get on with life.
So it's about the balance between...
And it had nothing to do with my blindness, but it had to make me strong.
Yep, definitely. Thank you, Pauline. That's very good points.
If I could just interject here briefly, Tricky Chaplin. I think the interplay when you have multiple disabilities is a definite factor. There might be things that you might do, you know, because you're at work and you're responsible for, you know, maintaining a role, and you've got people that are relying on you to do that. But when it comes to that more personal stuff, it can be a bit more difficult to find the motivation to get out and about, particularly as someone with hearing in the state that mine is. I do find that I have to psych myself up to get out and about, and that can mean that it's sometimes more isolated than with others.
I agree, yeah.
Martin Stewart, I think it's important to recognise how much extra focus and attention we need to spend in order to travel safely. It's amazing how much concentration is required for us to, let's face it, not fall under a bus or whatever. We've really got to take each step very carefully. I mean, my situation proves that. Very one poor step created a very major change for me. The other thing that really I draw attention to is particularly for us totally blind people, and that's the sleep disorders that a lot of us have to handle. And when you've got obligations the next day but you haven't had any sleep, will I or won't I go? Can I go? Should I mention it to someone? Well, I say yes, you should communicate openly, but often that's very, very difficult.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, those two issues. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.
Thanks. Susan Thompson here. Martin stole my thunder somewhat, but I think that the importance of good quality sleep is just pivotal. And I think because there is so much circadian rhythm disorder amongst those of us who are totally blind... I'm surprised how most of us stay sane.
Yeah.
Some of us don't.
And it's interesting with that, because I know I've had discussions with the NDIS about it, and they say it's health, but, you know, it's like, no, actually it's quality of blindness.
Yeah.
It's Steve Richardson, Paula. Ricky touched off nerve for me when he talked about multiple disabilities, and my other disability is that I have a bone condition. So my issue around travel isn't so much about hearing, but it's about getting safely from one point to another, not kind of knowing all the time what obstacles are in front of me, and it restricts me from doing things that I maybe haven't done before. Now I get to work on the train and all the rest of it once I'm familiar with a route. You know, it only takes one or two shots for me to pick it up, and I'm pretty good like that.
Yeah.
But if I'm in an unfamiliar area, I'm reluctant to go and take too many chances in case there is an obstacle, because if I fall, the chances of getting up are very low, or could be very low. And once that happens, of course, it's hospital and I'm off work for however many weeks. So I do everything I can to take safety into account.
Yeah.
And there are days that it is a real challenge, and sometimes I can't face it, and I've got to psych myself up to go and do things too.
Thanks, Steve.
Hi, it's Annette Ferguson here. I think the ongoing... dealing with the ongoing assumption that you're stupid and incompetent, you know, by friends and family and by strangers, you know, that you can't do stuff and that you've, you know, got to... desperately need help... and I find that mostly when I go to the city where I live, it's not such an issue, but people stop you in the street and, you know, constantly. And I think it's well-intentioned, but, you know, like I've had people recently not invite me to a place because they thought I couldn't see well enough to do what they were doing. And it's like, well, you could have asked, you know, that sort of thing. And I just find that kind of thing is ongoing. It kind of, you know, can grind you down at times. You've got to be aware of it and make sure that you do something to counteract it, you know, whether it's just a thought process or whatever.
Thank you.
Hi, Paula. It's Katrina Taylor. Just adding something in terms of the survival stuff. I always have a backup plan for when I travel. So if I can't find where it is I'm going or I've just completely disoriented myself, what's the backup plan? So I know that I've always got that, you know, what's the local taxi number? How do I find out where I am? So if all else fails, get a taxi, get out of there. So, yeah, I find for me that helps with the anxiety and also, again, planning ahead for the travel, trying to work out the best places to cross ahead, those sorts of things. And also for when feeling really crummy and crappy about the world is, for me, I have to go find something so I can recharge. So for me, that's doing something creative. Yep. That's what makes me feel good because I'm good at that stuff. And it's not about whether anybody else thinks what I'm doing is good. It's whether I think it's good and I'm doing it for my own benefit. Everyone else can just take a hike.
Mm. Mine is reading.
Hi, it's Jennifer. I wanted to just add something to Paula. Was it Paula or Pauline? About point about resilience. Oh, pardon, sorry, it's Pauline. I think that's a critical tool, and the way I've been able to strengthen it, have it, in addition to what's already been said, is being able to be really in tune with yourself, and you learn that as you get to know yourself, obviously, but understand what it is, how you're feeling, and not to be afraid of those feelings. And for times that are particularly difficult, for me, I've been able to put in place two things. One is the creative piece, because that's a welcome thing that can change the focus and clear the head and before coming back to revisit a situation or whatever the current circumstance is. And the other is to find people that I trust or appropriate help that can be there for those times that are really difficult. To be able to reach out to, whether it's a colleague that I mentor with, whether it's that's another person I trust, whether it's a psychologist or a doctor, but somebody that I've actually got the relationship with where I can revisit, rebounce, and then be recharged and get the help that I need in the times that are particularly difficult, and to have reaffirms that, Jen, you are okay, it's just this is the situation, then this is we can help you deal with it, and then you move forward.
Definitely, Jennifer, and I think that's really important. It's sometimes having that, even if it is a professional relationship, that it's separate, you can divulge anything and, you know, there is no judgment there, and that I think is definitely a really useful strategy, which I've used myself.
Paula, can I just jump in and ask you a question?
Yes.
How do the issues that are coming up on the floor here today, how do they compare with the results of your research so far?
I think they're definitely deeper. The results of the research sort of centred around, there were a lot of issues around access and not just accessing transport and the, you know, the local infrastructure, but also accessing printed material or having access to a sighted person if that's needed to read mail, etc. The trust and the bond with guide dog came up as an issue. I'm just trying to think because I don't have my notes here in front of me, so I'm kind of going by memory a bit, but also, even just mainstream things like relationships, you know, relationships with partner or spouse or family, children, owning a home or having a home that people can call their own, that was something that came up that was a contributor to subjective well-being. And spirituality came up, having a faith or religion, so something spiritual to turn to. So there's some of the things that came up just in the online survey part of my research. Yeah. I'm actually conducting a focus group, and it is okay now to mention that?
Yeah, go for it.
So I'm actually conducting, for people who are interested, a focus group. People need to be aged 18 to 34. There's already research out there that looks at different other age ranges. But so looking at, I'm doing that in December. If people want to email me, they can. And my email address, if people wanted to take it down, is phobley, phobley, at deakin, deakin, .edu.au.
And Paula, is that only open to people in Victoria, or is it...
No, is it telephone national, based? It's online.
Online.
Okay. It'll be an online. Zoom will be the platform that we'll be using, so...
I hope Jonathan Mosen's in the room. He'll be happy about that. More people will be reading his book. that's great. Paula, we've got one more comment and then I'm going to move on to talk to Vanessa. So, Michael?
Thank you. I've had my vision impairment since birth and had been with my wife since we were both in our early 20s and thought we'd had things pretty damn pat. Then... at about the age of 40, my wife discovered she had MS, and a year or two later we had our first and only child. So where we thought we had things going pretty smoothly and had the world sorted out, apart from the physical changes and demands, I can assure you that those changes made a really huge emotional change for all of us, and a lot of the issues that I thought I had really sorted out, I had to do a really big revisit to them.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Michael. That's a really interesting and I think important point, that it's not just about you, it's about your family and about, you know, changes that you have absolutely no control over, sometimes that can really challenge your emotional equilibrium, can't they? So I'm going to now talk to Vanessa. So Vanessa and I decided we'd do this in an interview style because I think it's actually incredibly courageous for someone to be willing, as someone who experiences a mental health issue, to be willing to talk about it in public, and especially with a group of peers. I actually think that can be even harder. I mean, I know because I've done it. But I think I really appreciate Vanessa agreeing to do this. I think she probably only did it because I gave a dinner.
I need better. I need different friends.
Yeah, that's right. I started off by saying you can say no, but
you won't get fed.
So I guess what I don't want to do is put anyone in a position where they have to go too deeply into their personal story. But Vanessa, but you do experience anxiety, and I guess I'm interested to know more about, rather than the circumstances of that, unless you want to talk about them, I'm probably more interested to know what is it that you do to manage it. And I know that you've had a long journey that's still ongoing, but how do you manage it? What works for you?
Okay. It's tricky one. I haven't done this before.
Probably never will again.
I feel the need for a guitar and a blue cocktail right now, but
we'll do that afterwards.
One thing I obviously do when I'm feeling anxious is probably use a bit of humour. I do self-medicate with Rescue Remedy, which I have here. Coke, as in the brown beverage of joy, not the white powder. And chocolate. I was seeing a psychologist, and he's saying, oh, what do you do to unwind? You know, do you have a wine? Or, and I'm like, no. Do I need to? Maybe I should develop a drinking problem. Would that help? there's the humour again. There are some very superficial things, but I think things that I have done in the last couple of years when all of this has sort of come to a head was just try and occupy my mind rather than dwell on things, because there can be a lot of negative self-talk. And so I was advised, you know, keep busy, because I wasn't working for a time and I'm used to being very busy and having lots of free time. So I thought, right, okay, I've got this free time. I wouldn't normally have it. Let's learn the harp. Why not? Okay, I'm still not very good, but I'm playing.
She is very good, actually.
With two hands, and, you know, so I've gained a skill. As a silver linings, I try and keep the glass half full. I think creative outlet is incredibly important. Another new thing I've done in the last year or so is to start making things out of a polymer clay called Fimo. So some people have seen my handiwork, just little objects, you know, little creatures and vegetables, and, you know.
Vegetables.
Carrots. I was commissioned to make I've made a number of carrots. Both recipients of the carrots are in the room. So very. But getting back to the point, which I'm desperately trying to remember what it was, talking about, sometimes short-term memory issues can be a bit of a side effect of anxiety, so I'm just trying to...
So let me move you on.
Good call. Oh, yes, I know what it was. Yep, creative stuff, that outlet. And also in 2015 I thought, I need to do something, I've got to get out. BCA convention. Thought, where better can I go that will be a safe place where people will understand if I can't find the loo or the door or whatever? So I came to the BCA convention in Perth, and that was a really good thing to do. Move me on
can
now.
Can I move you on now?
Yep.
The next thing I wanted to ask you, Ness, is how do you think blindness has impacted on your... on your anxiety? Do you think it's had it? Do you think it was the trigger, or do you think it's a side issue, or what do you think?
Oh, it's a tricky one, because I'm a music teacher. I work with children kindergarten to grade six in a classroom situation. I was in a situation where I was working in a very difficult school with absolutely no support. And I think the issues would have been similar for a sighted teacher, but because I guess I couldn't see what happened coming, it was a blindness thing, you know. It was a bit of a surprise, and also having to deal with management, about it and coming back to work, a lot of that was, it was all the blind thing, you know, that was foisted upon me, and it was like...
So you mean their issue?
Yeah, it was more... Blindness. Yeah. It's like, well, nothing had changed with my vision, you know, since I was diagnosed at 6 weeks, you know. It was the situation that had changed, and it was very difficult getting people to actually acknowledge that. So I had to do a lot of, well, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've been doing this in other places, and it hasn't been an issue.
It's very interesting, isn't it, how often your biggest advocacy, well, I don't know whether this is a generalisation, but it's certainly been my experience, that your biggest advocacy challenges sometimes come when you're actually at your lowest ebb, and that can be very challenging. And I think what's interesting is what you were saying about you still having to, whilst you're going through a terrible situation, terrible experience, having to still convince people that actually, yes, you're an intelligent, you know, articulate human being with skills, you're a qualified music teacher, and you're having to have that conversation. So it's not a dissimilar situation to what Fred was talking about this morning, in terms of, having a child taken away and then having to advocate to get that respect as a human being. Do you have any last kind of tips or tricks or suggestions you would make to people who might be experiencing anxiety or just wondering where to go or what to do?
I think it's probably a good thing to own it and not to be ashamed of it, because there is a bit of a stigma. And I find that in the past I would have hidden this under the carpet, you know, oh, no, no, I'm fine. You know, I've got to maintain that image of being a totally together, you know, professional who happens to be vision impaired. That isn't always possible. You know, it's very difficult to do that at times. And so you've just got to say, look, it's a problem. It is beyond my control. I certainly didn't come up with anxiety to get lots of time off of work, which is a whole other thing you have to deal with when it's a non-visual something. I broke my leg at school once, and that's a different story too. But no issues at all with everyone's understanding, oh gosh, that must be painful, you know, hope you're better soon. But when it's a mental issue, people can't see it, and the sight dependents tend to need to see it to understand it. Sorry for the sweeping generalisation, but I feel that I can here. And the point, yes, it's gone. You have to deal with a lot more of self-advocacy and come to terms with having to explain it and not feel responsible for it. It's not a reflection on me, I hope. No. It's a reflection on the lack of serotonin in my system.
And society's expectations.
Yes, that too.
Yes. Well, thank you. That I really appreciate you being so candid and, you know, sitting up here in front of everybody and having this conversation, because that is very brave. So I think Vanessa deserves a round of applause.
Just one thing. I'm going to be very cheeky here. While I was being all creative in my dark times, I produced a CD.
Oh, yes. No, that's allowed.
And yes. I was going to mention it in roll call, but that didn't quite happen. It's called Folk Songs for Soprano and Lute. A friend of mine is a lutenist, and I do have copies available for $20 if anyone would like one.
Oh, God. You and Graham Innes, I don't
You're know. A true musician.
Thank you. Thank you.
I also have a CD, but I don't want to talk about that now.
It's a really good one too.
Oh, yeah. You're a crawler. So that's good. Now I'd like to pass over to you, Bonnie, to talk about your research and do a practical exercise, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Just wanted to say thank you, everyone, for having me here, and also to Emma and Vanessa for sharing their stories about their own anxiety. I also, Vanessa, have the Rescue Remedy drops right here in front of me.
It's good stuff.
It's very good, because I always get nervous when I present, so I bring it with me. So as Emma said before, I've come from the Centre for Eye Research in Australia, or what we call as CERA for short. And I work there as a research fellow and also a clinical psychologist. And I've been there since 2012. CERA has actually led ophthalmology research in Australia over the past 20 years. And more recently, we've actually been listed as one of the top 5 eye research groups globally based on our scientific output. So we do really quite important work into eye disease. And some of the projects you might be aware of. So we focus on the prevention of blindness, and we've done projects such as the Bionic Eye and also the stem cells projects. And in the smaller group at CERA, which I belong to, we focus on the behavioural and also emotional aspects to vision impairment. More specifically, during the time that I've worked there, I've worked on 2 projects that have aimed to provide emotional support services to people with vision impairment and blindness. So we focus on aiming to provide those to the community, because depression and poor quality of life and also anxiety are really quite common in people with vision impairment. In fact, I think what the research shows is that about 7% of people with vision impairment will experience anxiety at any given time, and up to 43% of people with vision impairment experience depressive symptoms, which is really quite large, given that only about 16% of the general adult population without vision impairment experience depression at some stage in their life. But what we've also found is that despite the high prevalence of depression, that only a small percentage of people actually receive the support that they need. So we found that only 1 in 5 people with depression actually receive that support to manage their symptoms. And that's due to a lot of different factors, but most commonly, depression's quite often missed. And there's also not that many psychological interventions that actually focus on treating depression in people with vision impairment. And there's limited services also across Australia within vision rehab settings as well. And that's kind of across the world. So in the US, they showed that less than 25% of vision rehab services had access to psychological interventions, and less than 5% had access to a psychologist on site. But one of our studies actually showed as well that a lot of people do want support. So it was around 67% said that they really wanted that support. So that's why we focused on, first of all, identifying depression in people with vision impairment, and then on actually developing programs for people to treat the depression. So the first project that I was employed on was to train Vision Australia staff across Australia. And that was in a problem-solving model. And it was for those staff to be able to effectively provide that service to clients. And problem-solving is all about assisting with emotional well-being and depression and quality of life. And it's an evidence-based approach. So it's been used overseas. And it's shown to be effective for those things, so improving depression. And that's why we popped that into place. And problem solving really helps people to gain a sense of control when so many things are out of the person's control. And it's all about people taking action over challenges. So it was really set up to empower people to just manage those day-to-day challenges. And it's a common sense approach as well. So we all do some form of problem solving in our minds, but this one goes into more depth and more structure to solve problems more effectively. And it includes 7 steps. So first of all, it's about defining the nature of the problem, and then identifying a goal to work towards and considering the different, with the different solutions, then looking at the pros and cons of those different solutions after brainstorming. And then people choose the best solution based on the best benefits and break that down into a plan of action. So that's where people can really focus on starting to solve the problem and also look at how they went. That's the last step in the program. So because we all know that barriers pop up in life. And what we found from that research is the program actually did lead to reduced depressive symptoms in the people that we offered it to. And those changes actually stayed up until 12 months, which shows that it was really quite a helpful program. And so we were obviously very excited to see that that was assisting people with vision impairment emotionally and with their quality of life as well. So since that time, Vision Australia has actually taken that service up in their youth pre-employment program. And that's designed to assist young people between the ages of 16 to 25 to get the necessary skills for employment and also improve their employment prospects. And Vision Australia is also wanting to actually roll out problem solving across all of the staff members eventually, with their focus of having the staff more multi-skilled in the future. So in that research, we also found that there were quite a few risk factors to poor well-being in vision impairment. And they were people feeling like their health is deteriorating, also if a person has a history of depression, and what we call behavioural avoidance as well. So that last one is all about avoiding challenges when they pop up, which is really our natural tendency, but if it's used too much, it can actually impact on our lives, making our lives much more restricted and also increasing dependency on other people. And we also found factors that led to positive well-being, and that was greater age, and also greater use of social support, and also greater acceptance of vision impairment as well. So acceptance is all about living life to the fullest, despite frustrations or grief or sadness that goes along with vision impairment. and to everybody else, because everybody is human, we all experience those emotions. Mm. It's all about confronting challenges and adapting to changes in life. And acceptance is something that can fluctuate over time depending on what people experience at any given moment in their life and the different stressful factors. And low acceptance of vision impairment was what we found contributed to depression. That was one of the things that really impacted on people. And because of that, I focused on setting up another trial, which was an acceptance-focused guided self-help program, which is actually underway at the moment. And that program is based on a key message. So it's really about accepting what is out of your control and committing to action that improves life. And it follows the acronym ACT. So A stands for accepting thoughts and feelings and being present. C is choosing a valued direction in life. And T is taking action. Because we all know that we can hold on to our values strongly, but not necessarily take action in life. So that last part is very important. And the course focuses on also building an understanding of emotional well-being and how awareness of our emotional responses actually really helps us with our well-being. It talks about loss and grief as well, which are really common in vision impairment due to life changes that occur. For example, not being able to drive a car or do the things that people without vision impairment can do. And as humans, as I said before, we all experience the full range of emotions, and quite often sadness and frustration and anger can be quite common for people. And in fact, out of all the different emotions that we experience, 2/3 of those are uncomfortable. So this actually makes us more prone to experiencing these. And they're all associated with different sensations in our body, but they all do tell us something important about what we care about. So, for example, when we experience sadness, we can identify what is important to us in our lives, what we care about. And similarly with joy as well, we identify what motivates us in life. So essentially, we're all in the same boat with emotions. I identify with all of these emotions. I'm sure many of you do out there as well. And so that acceptance focus project was really to build on the awareness of emotions. Because a lot of research over time has actually shown that when we experience those emotions, we try very hard to push them away. And what happens when we push them away is that they just grow bigger and bigger, and then we tend to sink under. Kind of like those old movies where a person falls into quicksand. So the more the person struggles, the faster they get pulled under. So in the quicksand, the worst thing that a person can do is struggle in order to survive. The person must lay back and spread out their limbs and float to the surface. And that's very difficult, a very difficult thing to do, because every instinct in that person's body is telling them to fight. But if they do struggle, they'll drown. So lying back and floating is challenging emotionally. It doesn't come naturally, but it's a lot less effort than struggling. So that's kind of the same thing with emotions. And one of the components in the program is about building self-compassion. Essentially, this is about having your best friend by your side rather than your worst enemies. So quite often our minds can be quite critical when we experience emotions. So if we experience sadness, then our mind might say, you should get over this, those kinds of things. So it's having a caring voice inside your mind rather than that harsh voice. Other components were looking at what's important to people in their lives, so looking at their values and getting them to set goals to take them in a direction that they would like in their life. And then another really important part is all about mindfulness. So this is a pretty popular term at the moment, but a lot of research has boomed over the past 20 years in this practice, which is all about being in the present moment rather than being caught up in thoughts. And there's a famous quote from a guy named Leo Tolstoy. He says, there's only one time that's important, now. It's the most important time because it's the only time we have any power. So being here now and connecting now is very important for well-being. And that's That's stepping out of thoughts. So I wanted to give you all a bit of a skill to try out. And it's, I'm hoping it's something that you can memorise. It actually follows the acronym STOP. So S stands for slowing down. So this is when you're experiencing intense emotions. It's slowly breathing, or slowly pressing your feet into the ground, or slowly stretching. And then T stands for taking note. So noticing what you're feeling and thinking. Noticing the world around you, what you can hear, what you can sense, what you can touch, and what you're doing. And then O is about opening up. So that's all about making space for thoughts and feelings, just allowing them to freely flow through you. And P is pursuing values, so remembering your values and finding a way to act on them, no matter how big or small. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bonnie. So that's a really good practical skill that that people can use, and I won't be surprised to see people just randomly stopping in the middle of the corridor and causing a collision probably, but that's all right. I mean, that's good. Yeah, thank you very much, Bonnie, for that. That's really, really a good, that's a really good acronym for people to remember. We've probably, got time for maybe two questions of any of our panellists, remembering to steer clear of, you know, personal inquisitions, please. But any questions that people have for the panel, please.
All right, so this one's for Bonnie.
Who's speaking, please?
That's Troy Gladwell, sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just in relation to your research, is there a correlation between onset of blindness to acceptance, like how long on average it takes?
We haven't actually looked at that, but that would be really interesting. So I'm just about to have a look at the data for this acceptance focus project. So that's one of the factors I'll have a look at for you. And I'll get back to you on that.
Excellent. And will you be releasing a report of any, or a journal article? Or
yeah, the results will be published.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. And towards can you share that year with me so I can share?
Yes, I definitely can.
That'd be great. Any more questions?
Yep. One more. Yep. Hi. This is Sel.
Yep.
Emma, my question is for you because I know you a little bit. Have a family, you have this very demanding job, and you probably have other hobbies on the side. But how do you manage to keep it all? How do you stay on top of things?
No idea. No, seriously. I'll answer that seriously.
We invite her out for fried chicken. That's how she does
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. No, look, I think the way I stay on top of things is to make sure that I do carve out some time for myself each week, whether that be, you know, reading a book, even if it's reading a book on a plane, which is usually what it is, or if it's, you know, spending time with my kids on the weekend, or, you know, spending time with Vaughan or whatever it is, I try and make sure that I carve out that time. I'm also a really social person, so I need, you know, friends and family around me, so that stuff is really important. But the other thing is I've just learnt to manage my expectations of myself, I haven't learnt. It's a work in progress. I'm trying hard to manage my expectations of myself so that, you know, I recognise that, you know, some things I just have to let go of. Hopefully they're not raising my children, because that's kind of important. But I try to be, I just try not to be so hard on myself and try not to be such a perfectionist, so that, you know, because I think that's probably my biggest challenge. So I just try to, and also delegation. I try hard to delegate where I can, both personally and professionally, and try to recognise that I don't actually have to have all the answers, and I don't have to be the person who does absolutely everything. And I think that's something that we all need to remember, that we can't do everything. But, you know, to be honest, there are days when it is really difficult, and that's fine. I'm quite happy to admit that. And I think that it's really important to be honest and upfront about the fact that sometimes things are difficult, because that's the only way that you can get support. So that's probably it. Does that answer your question, Zell?
I just wanted to know whether there's a mental health support network within the blind community, you know, that people can refer to, you know, or program.
And can you say your name for us?
Bonnie, do you want
to? Oh, sorry, my name's Trudy Ryle.
Yeah, thanks, Trudy. I'll get Bonnie to respond to that.
Unfortunately, that's why we have popped these programs into place, because there is that gap there, and there's actually also limited psychologists that have the specialised training in working with people with vision impairment and also hearing impairment as well, and that's why it's so important to fill this, and that's why I'm here. I'm hoping to provide this support and keep it growing so that everybody has access to that specialised support, rather than having to go to someone who doesn't fully understand about vision impairment. But there are also support groups available within Vision Australia, such as quality living groups. Those kinds of services are available.
I guess, Trudy, I would just add that, you know, BCA, of course, is a peer support organisation, and one of the reasons we're having this session is to start the conversation. It's not the end of the conversation by any means, because everybody has an individual story, and we haven't even scratched the surface of what, you know, what people would like in this space and what people would like BCA to do in this space. So, you know, there's certainly opportunity for you to, if you wanted to, put forward a recommendation to BCA that we establish some sort of group that's specifically for people with mental health issues to share experiences and so forth. And that's something that, you know, we could certainly look into. So, this is just the start of the conversation. I'm happy to talk to you about it more after convention. Look, I just want to take this opportunity to thank our panellists very much. Paula Hobley, who's travelled a significant distance to be here today under very difficult circumstances. Thank you very much, Paula.
It all worked out.
In the end.
And I had a very nice
metro
boy.
Oh, younger. I'm glad we could help. And Bonnie, thanks to you so much for your insights and for your STOP acronym. I think that's excellent. And Vanessa, thank you to you for saying yes. And that dinner was really nice too. It's really, really good to have you involved, and appreciate you sharing your story with us. Just finally, I also want to extend really sincere thanks to Lynn Davis, our Vice President, without whom we wouldn't have this session. Lynn, alongside me, was a really strong advocate for this session, and really helped with putting it together and defining, you know, the shape of it. Lynn, I wonder to finish with whether it would be possible to hand over to you, because I haven't got in front of me that fantastic quote that you had in your notes, and I wonder if you could share that with us as a closing comment. Sorry for putting you on the spot. Yeah.
Well, I very hurriedly wrote some notes for Emma a week or so ago, and they didn't progress very far, but what came to mind very early on in the process was... probably when I was in my 20s, feminists were very fond of saying at the time that Ginger Rogers was a much better dancer than Fred Astaire, because she had to dance backwards on high heels. And I thought, you know, I think that for those of us who are blind or vision impaired, in a sighted world, because that's what it is, that's actually what we're doing. We're Ginger Rogers. And we really need to think about, for each one of us, you know, we have to take our own emotional temperature and then think about what we might be able to do individually and collectively, just to continue the metaphor a bit. Should we get off the dance floor? Should we dance differently? Should we take off the high heels? I'm not sure, you know, how far the metaphor stretches, but I liked it at the time, and I'm glad Emma liked it too. And I do think that we really are Ginger Rogers.
So on that note, because we are all Ginger Rogers, I'm going to hand back to Ricky to tell us about arrangements for dinner, because, you know, there might be opportunities to be Ginger Rogers at dinner. Who knows? I don't. But anyway, Ricky.